So my apologies to those who are with us on the live stream and missed our opening comments. We were just reviewing a little bit as we picked up on Balaam's third oracle, and Homer's read that for us in Numbers chapter 24, verses 1 through 11. One of the things that I've pushed, and maybe I've seemed a little bit pushy from your perspective, as Balaam's kind of spoken of as almost a neutral Bible character, one of the things that I've really pushed is that Balaam isn't a true blue, called by God prophet, if you will. Now, I'm not denying the fact that he certainly is a prophet. That is, he speaks on behalf of God. But I think he was more so a vessel that God used rather than a man who was called to a specific ministry to give himself and serve the Lord. For one, you look at the commitment and you look at the faithfulness of the men that God has called as prophets in times past. They were moral men. They were faithful men. They were obedient. They were true messengers. They were committed to God and committed to his people. Balaam is none of those things. He doesn't have any love for Israel. He has a love for wealth, as we're going to see, which is one of his primary problems. And kind of the idea that I put forth is that I believe Balaam was more like a sorcerer that the Lord just happened to use because of perhaps his reputation or his ability, whatever the case was. And one of the reasons why I've pushed that, I hope you don't think that that's just my opinion, bar evidence. But if you look there at Numbers chapter 24 and verse 1, Balaam saw that it pleased the Lord to bless Israel. He didn't go as at other times to look for the omens. And I think Homer actually used the word sorcery, but he set his face toward the wilderness. And remember, prior to trying to summon God, if you will, to determine his will, he has Balak offer these various sacrifices. And it seems like that just kind of points once again to what Balaam's mode of operation was, that he was a diviner, and how they would use the animal parts, the animal insides, to determine the future, define the future, to bring themselves into this spiritual plane. So it says he didn't go about his normal practicing as he otherwise had to look for omens, but rather he set his face toward the wilderness. And so that's just to me one more thing that really validates this man isn't a true prophet of God who sees himself wholly committed to the Lord. Rather, he's a diviner who the Lord is speaking through as a means of convenience. And so it's almost like he looks toward the wilderness, and remember, Israel's camped out on the plains of Moab. And whether he looks toward, I don't know that he's so much looking toward the Israelites. It's almost like he sees that God wants to bless these people. He knows that God's going to use him to bless them again. And it's almost like he's turning away toward the wilderness where he doesn't have to see them. And the Spirit of God just overpowers him. And you know, Dave pointed out last week rightly, you can't disrupt God's sovereign plan and God's ability to bring about and accomplish his will. And despite Balaam, he's trying to turn away almost from the people of Israel so that, as Balak said, if you can't curse him, at least don't bless him. He's trying to prevent that third blessing. Well, he turns away, and you see what happens in verse 2. The Spirit of God came upon him, and he brings about another oracle and another blessing. So rather than pronouncing a curse, he pronounces a blessing. And if you think about this, one of those verses in particular, that last verse in verse 9, look at that last phrase there. You'd think that he would have realized this. You'd think Balak would be listening to what he's saying. He's there to curse Israel. And yet at the very end of this oracle, number 3, blessed are those who bless you, and cursed are those who curse you. What he's done is he has pronounced a curse upon himself for trying to curse the people, and he's placed a curse upon Balak for trying to have him curse the people. So, you know, those are words that were spoken to Abraham, this divine promise of protection, where you remember God told Abraham, this great nation I'm going to make of you, whoever blesses you, I'll bless. Whoever curses you, I'll curse. And so it's almost as if he brings this curse upon himself, because that's what he's there trying to do. And he ends this oracle, blessed are those who bless you, speaking of Israel, and cursed are those who curse you. And Balak's angry. He's had enough. He slaps his hands together and he says, I brought you here to curse the people 3 times. You bless them. You haven't fulfilled your responsibility. Verse 11, though, it stood out to me for a long time because of the significance of it and the way that it relates to the way that people think about God. And I want to ask you about this. Listen to verse 11 again. Therefore, flee back to your own place. I said, I will certainly honor you, but the Lord has held you back from honor. So I want y'all to think about that. What can we imply from Balak's parting words to Balaam? I wanted to honor you. God has held you back from honor. So what do we make of that? What do you make of that statement?
He's trying to he's still trying to convince Balaam, but he's he's not giving the Lord the credit. He's, I don't know what I'm trying to say. He is.
Keep talking. Maybe it'll come out.
All right.
If not, you make us laugh.
But I had this. I had read this, and I said I had to make a comment here.
Yeah, it's all a significant statement to me.
He's elevating himself to be equal with God.
Yeah.
I could have done this for you.
Okay, he's elevating himself to be equal with God, Buster.
I was thinking, well, the world can offer you all of this to the world, but you know, you're going to live a godly life. You're restricted. Yeah.
That's along the lines of what I was thinking. Now, I'll touch on that in just a minute. Dad brought out something, too, that's worth looking at as well. Mom?
He's planting a seed of regret. Okay.
As we're going to see, Balaam is, although he's not able to directly do what Balak wanted him to do, he's going to accomplish the same thing in a roundabout way, as we're going to look at as we get further along. So, Dick, do you think of it?
I remember what I was going to say. What's interesting to me is that Balak knew God, or knew the Lord, evidently.
Okay.
He knew of him, at least, because he made his statement.
He probably would have recognized his existence. I wouldn't say he knew him, say intimately, obviously, but he obviously knew of God. And that was the perspective of the people back then. You know, they were very, very quick to associate. If a nation was strong and powerful, then they credited the nation's God, or gods in most instances, with being the source behind their success, say physically, monetarily, in war, whatever the case was. They credited the God with their success. And so he recognizes the existence, if you will, of Yahweh, that is Israel's God. But at the same time, he still holds to his deities, doesn't he? Despite seeing that Yahweh is more powerful than him. Dad had pointed out one of the things that Balaam is doing is he's elevating himself to God. God could bless you. I could have blessed you too. I could have honored you. And really where I was getting was where Buster's comment comes in. This is the promise of the world. Look at what God is keeping you from having. You know, I could have honored you. I could have given you pleasure. I could have given you everything that you wanted to experience. You know, what God does is God keeps you back from that. God keeps you back from fun. God keeps you back from blessing. God keeps you back from honor. God keeps you back from all of the things that the world can give you. And that's false. That's not true. So let's not think that is for a moment. God can give us something much grander, much more filling, much more satisfying than what the world can offer us. But this is the way the voice of Satan so often works in our mind when it comes to temptation. God, and how many times have you heard people say, I'm just not that interested in Christianity because it just keeps me back from doing all the things I want to do. Well, yes, it does keep you back from sinning. It keeps you back from living immorally. It keeps you back from indulging in every desire of your flesh. And so this is the promise of the world. Balak says to Balaam, I could have honored you, but God has kept you from that. And as Buster pointed out, and it's kind of where I'm coming from too in this question, the world sees God in that way. He's just a killjoy. He just holds us back from all of the things that would be fun and all of the enjoyments that this life has to offer. Tommy?
Mm-hmm. The devil talked to him, offering all these things that would be desirable
mm-hmm.
in flesh.
Right.
But, you know, Jesus chose to serve God and get through him. And we face that choice daily. And all the little things we do every day, we have choices we have to make. Well, yeah, that sounds like fun, but I shouldn't do that. We have to make these choices if we want to serve God.
It's a choice we make every day. Good observation there, Tommy. And let's not fool ourselves and say that temptation and sin isn't fun, because absolutely it is. In a carnal, fleshly way, it is satisfying. But understand, it's always momentary. It's always short-lived. We know this, don't we? It's like Adam and Eve in the garden. You know, the devil comes along and God's blessed them with all of these trees and fruits and things that they can eat and enjoy. And he brings out the one thing that they can't have, and he says, this is what you want. And she looks at that, and she wants that, and she gets that. Adam and Eve eat from the tree they're commanded not to. Their eyes are opened, and the very thing, the very pleasure it was supposed to bring was so short-lived, you know, and it just brought pain and anguish and regret and sorrow and sin, and that's how sin works. So I'm not going to add to the many comments that were made. We've made the point good enough. But implicitly, what Balak is saying, you need to ditch God so you can enjoy life. And that's the message that the world speaks to us. And like Tommy said, we really have to focus on the fact the blessings of God are greater and they're more fulfilling, and they're more satisfying, and they're longer lasting than the momentary pleasures that sin will give us. All right, let's finish off the chapter.
Before we get off of that, I want to bring up a quick point. It's interesting in verse 3 and 4, the Balaam talking about himself. He said, the utterance of a man's eyes be open, the utterance of a man who hears the word of God, sees the vision of the Almighty, falls down with his eyes wide open. He says this, but his heart is not in his words.
Yep.
I think what Balaam would do was the opposite. When Balaam was healed, what did he say? He said, I see now that the Lord is the only God.
Mm-hmm.
So you got two men that have an interaction with God, and one of them sees God for who he is, and the other sees nothing but what he wants.
It's the same way in the world today, isn't it? I mean, those are the kind of people that are in the world. Those are the kind of people that are in the church. People who see but don't see, as Jesus said, and then people whose eyes have been cleared so that they're able to see the Lord and see His work and see His blessings and the benefits of serving Him.
And I think the Pharisees brought, they said, come down off the cross, and we'll believe you. They'd seen Him raised the dead, feed thousands of people with very little, heal all kinds of ills, perform all kinds of miracles. But now they're saying, come down off the cross, and we'll believe you.
No, never.
It wouldn't have happened.
Nah.
People in general are born to do what they want to do. Very little that can change before you do.
And it's the power of the gospel that opens the eyes of men and the heart that's willing to receive it. Balaam didn't have such a heart. Many in the world do not have such a heart. We're looking for those who do have such a heart. All right, let's finish up verses, I think it's 12 through 25 is the end of the chapter. It's kind of a lengthy reading. Dave, would you mind reading that for us, Numbers 24, 12 through 25? Thank you, Dave. So this final oracle, if you will, is unprompted. Rather, he goes to Balak and says, let me tell you how it's all going to end up. Three times he's tried to curse the people of God. Three times he's ended up blessing them. And pretty much what he's saying here is that, you know, the kingdom of the Lord is going to dispossess all of the nations. Is going to, you know, as we're told, you know, God is going to ultimately reign. And the most famous prophecy that Balaam makes is actually found here in verse 17, where he says, I see him, but not now. I behold him, but not near. So he sees something far off, although it's been revealed to him, the fulfillment and accomplishment isn't anytime soon. A star shall come out of Jacob, and a scepter shall rise out of Israel. It'll crush the forehead of Moab, and it'll break down all the sons of Sheth. So what he's pointing toward is the Messiah. You know, the scepter is the idea of royalty, kingship, and star, glory, power is going to come. And as Jesus was going to do, he was going to crush all of his foes, and he was going to bring, you know, Daniel 2 tells us of this great kingdom that God's going to establish, that's going to, you know, crush all others, demolish all other worldly nations. We understand that isn't in a physical, earthly sense, but rather it's in a sense in which, you know, God's dominion is going to fill the earth, and through the power of the gospel, the hearts of men will be softened and will bring them under subjection to the authority of Christ. Yes, there will be those that resist, but ultimately they will be destroyed. And so, you know, making this last foretelling, Balaam tells Balak, you know, God is going to reign. These people, there's going to be a king coming forth from these people who will reign and defeat all of his enemies, and including in there not just Moab, but the Edomites and the Kenites, the Amalekites, and many others as well. So, you just have to look at Balaam and see, it's such a sad story. Despite having, like Dad said, opened eyes and knowing the knowledge of the Most High and hearing the words of God and seeing visions of the Almighty, Balaam knows nothing in his heart about the Lord because he knows nothing of obedience and righteousness. So he makes this final foretelling of the Messiah and of the kingdom that God's going to ultimately establish that will be ruled by Christ, which would outlast and crush all others. And after this final pronouncement, they go their own way. All right, question 9. Dick, you want to do that for us?
Although God prevented Balaam from cursing Israel, how did he cause them to stumble? Well, in 25:1, it talks about whoredom with Moab, and so by having them interact with the Moabites, he had them they turned from God and sinned because of that.
Yep. All right, so he, through use of the Moabites, he joined them to participate in immorality. Let's just read that, Numbers 25, first three verses. While Israel lived in Shittim, the people began to whore with the daughters of Moab. They invited the people to sacrifice to their gods, and the people ate and bowed down to their gods. So Israel yoked himself to Baal of Peor, and the anger of the Lord was kindled against Israel. Now, remember I told you that Peor, when Balak took Balaam to that top of Mount Peor, it seemed to be the center of Baal worship. And that's why he's referred to in Numbers 25:3 as Baal of Peor. That was the place where, you know, his center of worship was. Baal was the god of fertility. And it probably doesn't take a lot of imagination to determine how one would go about worshiping the god of fertility. So seduced by the women of Moab, Israel yoked herself to Baal of Peor. Now, we're not going to read the rest of chapter 25, but we're told that the wrath of God ensued upon the people because of their disobedience, with the result being he sent forth a plague that was going to kill 24,000 people. And so ultimately what Balaam wanted to do in weakening Israel, he was able to do. He wasn't able to do it by pronouncing a curse upon them. That was not allowed. But we're going to see in just a moment, Numbers 31, if you want to turn there, under his advisement, Balak was able to bring Israel into this relationship with the Canaanite deity Baal through use of idolatry, and the result being God's anger struck out against the people. Israel was weakened, and it was kind of a circumventing the method that Balak intended. However, it was able to accomplish the same thing. There in Numbers 31, look at verses 15 and 16. We'll see how that happened, and you'll see why I'm saying this is Balaam's fault. Numbers 31, 15, and 16. We'll tell you what, but let's back up to verse 13. So Moses and Eleazar the priest and all the chiefs of the congregation went to meet them outside the camp. And Moses was very angry with the officers of the army, the commander of thousands, and the commander of hundreds who had come from service in the war. Moses said to them, "Have you let all the women live? Behold, these, on Balaam's advice, caused the people of Israel to act treacherously against the Lord in the incident at Peor, and so the plague came among the congregation of the Lord." Okay, so we're not told that it was Balaam in chapter 25, but after, you know, what we have in Numbers 31 is that they were acting on Balaam's advice. And so he couldn't curse Israel, but he wanted to arrange a situation because he still wanted that honor. He still wanted the money that Balak had promised him. And so he got what he wanted after all, in part. He didn't curse the people, but through his oracles, he blessed them. But through the influence of idolatry, he was able to bring Israel into disobedience to God and the displeasure of God. And God struck out against them and punished them. Remember, though, the very first oracle he made, he makes this statement where he says, "Let me die the death of the righteous." It's unfortunate that Balaam did not do that by the least. What was the fate of the prophet? I'll just go ahead and answer that one. He was killed. You know, Numbers chapter 31, if you'll back up to verse 8, we see they killed the kings of the Midian with the rest of their slain. Evi, Rechem, Zur, Hur, Reba, the five kings of Midian. They also killed Balaam, the son of Beor, with the sword. So Balaam lost his life in battle. Now, this is Moses' last major situation, last major battle before he dies and he's removed from service, and Joshua is going to replace him. And so Israel was wrong in their eagerness to worship Baal. However, Balaam was wrong in his use of the Midianite and the Moabite women to influence them to worship false gods and to worship Baal in particular. And so he was held accountable for his part in their sin. And the result was that Israel was going to punish the nation that led them into sin, and they were going to punish the one. This is the judgment of God, by the way, not just of Israel getting revenge, just this holy war decreed by God to punish these people for their part in leading his people astray. And so Balaam is killed, and many of the Midianites, many of the Moabites were killed as well. So thus concludes the story of Balaam. Dick?
Jack, sin could affect our life just like that. We can end up spiritual dead just like Balaam.
Sure. Yep. And he was so interested in gaining what this life had to offer. And that's oftentimes what sin promises us, isn't it? What this life has to offer. But the result, the catastrophic. Balaam lost more than his life. You know, Balaam lost his soul. And he sold it for the meager honor that Balak, king of Moab, was willing to give him. He sold out the people of God. He rejected the voice of the Lord. He walked according to, as we're going to see, the greed and lust of his own heart. And the result was the Lord put him to death. And unless he repented, which I don't think Scripture really gives us anything to hope according to that. And as we're going to see, the New Testament commendation of him is anything but pleasant. Then it cost him a whole lot more than just his life. All right, let's move on to our discussion questions. Anyone have comments, questions that they want to make on kind of the narrative portion of our study?
All the king had to do was just let Israel pass.
Yeah, I mean, Israel was no threat to them.
Because God told them not to.
Yeah. Israel was no threat to them, but such it is. Such it is. Oftentimes, the enemies of God view his enemies as dangerous and as threats and lash out against them. All right, discussion question. We have about 15 minutes to get four questions in anyway. I'm intending to skip one of the questions for reasons that will be made known later. All right, question one. Do you think Balaam was a Jew or a Gentile? Miss Johnny, I like that eagerness. Okay. All right. I'd be interested sometime, you know, to hear more so that lineage. I couldn't find a particular lineage for Balaam. That being said, that doesn't mean that one doesn't exist. So the point being, we see nowhere that to indicate that he did come through Isaac. Miss Johnny said that he descended from one of Abraham's other sons, which even if that were the case, unless he came through Isaac, then he would be considered a non-Jew, which to be a non-Jew is to be a Gentile. We do know that Abraham had other sons after Sarah died. He took a second wife, Keturah, and fathered sons through them. And although they were sons of Abraham, they weren't according to promise. Okay, as Paul points out in Romans chapter 9, he also had Ishmael too, remember him? So they went and became great nations, but Abraham sent them all away. So
he wasn't with him,
No, he certainly wasn't with them. So Right. You're right. So, by all accounts that I can gather, he was a Gentile prophet. Anybody get anything different? Anything to the contrary? Okay. So, could you find any other Gentile prophets in Scripture?
Found several.
Did you?
Yeah.
All right.
Beor.
Where do you see that at? Where'd you see Beor at? Balaam was the son of Beor, right?
Yeah.
Are you talking about his father? Okay. Where at? Do you have a verse for that? Maybe you can get it for me later if you don't have it with you.
I didn't write enough stuff down here.
Okay.
Well, what about Elihu?
Elihu?
Yeah. Genesis.
Okay. Wait, Job?
Job. Eliphaz.
Okay.
Bildad.
Okay. Yeah, I know. You're talking. I think you're pointing to Job and his three friends. Bildad, Elihu was a fourth guy that kind of came in later. Oh, what were their other names?
Zophar,
Bildad, and there's another one I can't. Eliphaz. I think you had said that one, Dick. As to whether they were prophets or not, I would vacillate on that. I wouldn't be certain. I would say this: they're not Jews. Those men that you mentioned. Anybody else get anything on those, Tommy?
How about Melchizedek?
Okay, priest of the Most High God. Not a Jew. Obviously, he was a contemporary of Abraham, so impossible, right, for him to be a Jew. So, the question is: would he be a prophet? That, you know, prophet and priest were separate offices. Sometimes you'd have an individual who was both prophet and priest, but as to whether he was, I know he's called a priest. Is he called a prophet in the text?
No, but he gives that blessing.
Okay, he does bless. I could be wrong on this, but it seemed like blessings were more of a priestly responsibility. Like I said, I could be wrong on this. This is really getting deep into some Old Testament that I'm just not brushed up on. In Numbers chapter 6, and I think it's verse 24, you have what's called the priestly blessing. And the sons of Aaron, who were the priests, would, you know, every day, I think, they would, you know, say to the people, they would bless the people, you know, the Lord bless and keep you, the Lord make His face shine upon you, the Lord turn His countenance towards you and give you peace. That's what's called the priestly blessing, I believe. As to whether prophets gave blessings or not, I would have to, you know, I wouldn't be surprised by that by any means. That being said, I think Melchizedek, certainly the office of priest is communicated, but whether the office of prophet isn't, I'm not as sure about that one. But that's a potential answer. Good. Anybody else? Okay. Personally, I didn't find a whole lot. And some of those that were mentioned, Job, Elihu, Job's friends, Melchizedek, they might somewhere be related to a prophet, and they were certainly all Gentile. Most of them predating Abraham. However, I wasn't able to come with a lot. So one of the things I've kind of correlated to that then is Balaam, who was, although he was a prophet, was also a wicked man. He was a Gentile, I believe. Can you think of any other wicked men like Balaam that God used in Scripture to speak through? Tommy?
Mm-hmm. And
it ends
up, both of them, or he is killed by a lion.
Okay, yeah. That's a strange story. You know, I'm not even going to begin to delve into that. That's a strange story. He deceived, like you said, an innocent, true prophet of God, and then he turned and prophesied the young man's death. You know, so I would classify him under that. That's one I just don't grasp. And I know I preached on it before, but that doesn't mean I fully understand it. I can explain and bring some lessons out from that. But I can't explain everything that's there, and I don't know that anybody can. Yeah, that's a good one. Any others? Okay, Saul. Yeah, he's one I jotted down. 1 Samuel 19 and verse 20. So Saul prophesied. Caiaphas is another that God spoke through him, the high priest. Remember, he said it's profitable. You know, they're kind of debating killing Jesus, and he stands up, and he's the high priest at the time, and he says, you know, better for one man to die for the nation than for all the nation to die. Meaning, if Jesus continues, then Israel's going to be dispossessed. Judah's going to be dispossessed of their authority and their independence by Rome. So better to kill one man and the nation be spared rather than, you know, to allow this one man to continue and the nation to suffer as a whole. And then the divine commentary is that he didn't speak this on his own, rather he spoke it as a prophet. And so, wicked man that he was still a mouthpiece for God to communicate his will. So, very interesting comments on that, much better than I expected. So, thank you for bringing those up. And Tommy, I'm going to just go ahead and say, I believe probably a priest, a prophet and a priest would both be in that position to where they could bless someone. You certainly see the prophets pronouncing woes upon the people, which that's the opposite of a blessing, that's a cursing. But as voices of God, then I think that they probably, along with that, would be able to bless the people as well. In fact, that's what we see Balaam doing, isn't it? he goes to pronounce a woe upon the people, but he instead pronounces a blessing on them. So as to the certainty about Melchizedek being both prophet and priest, certainly priest, maybe prophet. Wouldn't argue that with you by any means. All right. Question two, and this is one I really wanted to get to. God's initial response to Balaam was to go and curse Israel, and he said no. Remember, first time Balaam asks, God says, no, you can't go. Do not go with them. Do not curse him. Balaam comes back and asks again, remember? So the second time, God tells him yes. And yet we're told, despite the fact that God told him yes, he's angry that Balaam went, despite giving his permission. And so all of that to say, here's my question. Why might God have allowed the prophet to go, only then to act in anger toward him? Okay. He knew Balaam's heart. Balaam was determined to go. Tommy?
Yeah, that's a hard question. You almost have to try to think like God does,
Mm-hmm.
But I studied the text, King James Version,
mm-hmm.
very closely. The only thing I can see from the text is that verse 20, God says, if
verse 20?
Verse 20, yes. It says, if, that's number 22.
Mm-hmm. Right.
If the men come to Saul, this is after he goes through him the second time, he'll ask him,
mm-hmm.
go with me. And then verse 21, it appears that Balaam didn't wait, but rose immediately and left, I guess called his eagerness to go and acquire wealth or whatever. But
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay.
That's the only thing I can see. I don't know what that word semantics.
Yeah, semantic, yeah.
It's just a hard question.
Okay. Dave?
You have another example of that with the manna. What he does, the basically the same thing. He tells them, yeah, you can help me here. You'll get it. As soon as they go out there, they're fulfilling their flux.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. So, what's the word for what God was doing to them? Well, the word I'm thinking of, and there could be a thousand words. That's even harder than that question, isn't it? Why did y'all not tell me my PowerPoint wasn't on? I'm disappointed. Last time I did that, somebody corrected my thing shortly after that. So
they had their answer. He had his answer. It was
okay.
In the story.
Yeah.
Don't go.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Miss Johnny?
I think he was teaching them a lesson.
I think that's a good way to say it. I was gonna use the word judgment. I think that's what God, similar to what God was doing with the children of Israel when he sent the quail. So you want meat? Here it is. But it wasn't a blessing, and he knew that they were going to eat it. But the point of it was to bring judgment, to bring the plague. I think that's why he tells Balaam, okay, go ahead. You know, we can deal with you here and now. Thus, remember, he sent the angel of the Lord to oppose him those three times, and you know, had the donkey not intervened and saved his life, he'd have died. He'd have suffered punishment. Tommy?
Yeah. I really like what Dave said about the lust in your heart.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you know, they read it from Kremlin to 12 fast, they wouldn't worry about anything else. I think that's yep.
Yep, and we talked about how Balaam was almost overcome by his compulsion for the money, his lust for the money, you know, so that he's almost acting in a sense, you know, where he's insane. So, no, did I see another hand somewhere? Johnny?
I think he did. I think he Okay? Sometimes you see God doing that, acting in such a way to show his power, put his power on display. And so, you know, he's trying to bring Balaam around. He wants Balaam to be able to see. So Balaam is certainly acting out of in disobedience to God because God's angry with him, despite the fact that God said, if they come, you can go. So it's we got some good answers there. It could be judgment. It could be God displaying his power. It could be a semantical thing. One other thing we may consider, I think it could be a test. I think, you know, the Lord could have been saying, okay, let me test Balaam and see what he's going to do. You know, we see that happening, the Lord testing people. And by saying, I've made my will clear, but by now making this allowance where he can go, I'm gonna test him. He knows what I want, but I'm going to open the door. And if he chooses to go through it, well, he's failed the test because he kindled God's anger against him. So many of those good answers that might explain kind of what's going on there. We're going to hold off there. We're just about out of time. We got a couple more questions. We'll touch on these next week and try not to linger too long. I do want to get a good start on our study with Hezekiah. I tell you, Hezekiah was a very interesting study for me in preparing that, and just very beneficial. I was very encouraged, especially coming up on a study off like a guy like Balaam. I mean, this hard-headed, disobedient, sinful, lustful, Hezekiah is everything that Balaam was, and he was a man of God in the core of his heart, and I'm looking forward to studying him as well. So think about the last two questions that we've got. We're going to talk about the power of greed and the love of money, which I think for the day and age in which we're living is quite relevant. And then the very last question, that is, how is Balaam portrayed by the New Testament writers? And we'll touch on a few verses in the New Testament to get a little commentary from the Holy Spirit as to the character that he saw Balaam with. So, thank you for your participation in our class this morning.